Where is our music to come from? Verse 19 says, in your heart, and literally means from your heart, from out of an internal source. The point of origination is the heart. In other words, music in and of itself is not the issue. It is the heart of the one singing that is the issue.
Doesn't matter what kind of church you go to, maybe big or small, Baptist, Presbyterian, or non-denominational, urban or rural, you're going to sing. Music is as much a part of any church service as prayer and preaching. But it seems that every church approaches music differently. Some have choirs, others have bands. Some don't even use instruments. So if you were designing a music program and you wanted to make sure it honored God, what biblical principles should guide you? Consider that today on Grace to You, as John MacArthur shows you what Scripture says about psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. His current study is from Ephesians chapter 5, and it's titled Living in the Spirit. Now, with today's lesson, here's John.
In Ephesians 5:18, it says, if you're filled with the Spirit, you sing. In Colossians 3:16, it says, if the word of Christ dwells in you richly, you'll sing. In James 5:13, it says, if your heart is filled with joy, you'll sing. And that is true. God has given us song as an expression of joy. Now, we've asked several questions. Let's look at them again. First little question is, among whom do we sing? Among whom do we sing? Simply says, in verse 19, speaking among yourselves. We sing among ourselves. Secondly, from where does it originate? Where is our music to come from? Verse 19 says, it says at the end of the verse, in your heart. And literally means from your heart, from out of an internal source. The point of origination is the heart. In other words, music in and of itself is not the issue. It is the heart of the one singing that is the issue. That's the issue before God. And you can sing the most beautiful song in the world. You can sing the most God-glorifying words in the world. But if your heart is not right before God, the song doesn't please Him, no matter how well you sing it. People, I'm telling you, today in the church, we have lost sight of that. We have piled up in Christianity a stack of musicians and singers and so forth whose hearts are not right before God, who are constantly being promoted and pushed and portrayed and across the Christian scene. And God is not interested in their songs if their hearts are not right. I'm not trying to eliminate all these people from ministry. I just think maybe they ought to back up and get their life right before they claim to represent God's music, because He's interested in the heart. In fact, the music of the world, you know, you don't want to identify with that anyway. Our music ought to be different. The music of the world is going to stop someday. Do you know that? Every radio station that plays music is going to stop. All the instruments are going to stop. No more world's music at all. You say, when's that? Revelation chapter 18. If you want to read it, I'll show you verses 20 to 22. In Revelation 18, God has brought judgment on the world system. And here the world system is called Mystery Babylon. Babylon was the origination of the evil world system, and it'll be the consummation of it. And so this final form of the Antichrist's world system is called by the term Babylon. And he tells here how Babylon in chapter 18 is going to be wiped out at the end of the tribulation. And when it's wiped out, then Christ will return and set up His kingdom. And one of the things that's going to take place is this. Verse 21, it says an angel takes like a stone, like a great millstone, casts it into the sea, and says, with that kind of violence shall the great city Babylon be thrown down. And when the whole system goes, look what goes first, verse 22. And the voice of harpers and minstrels and flute players and trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee. That is the end of the world's music. It's over. God says, that is enough. It is gone. All non-spirit-filled music will halt immediately. You know, it's almost as if God has given music to mankind. It's a wonderful blessing. But man has corrupted that gift of God like he corrupts every other gift of God. And so the day is coming when God will remove it. Can you imagine a world without music? Can you imagine? People in our society can't make it from their house to their car to get the radio on. and from their car back to their house to get the stereo on. The music plays at work. The music plays at the factory. It plays at the shop. It plays at the halftime of the football game. Music plays constantly. People don't want to face life without the music because the music plants the thoughts in their minds, the words in their minds to keep them from thinking about the stuff that matters. The world without music will be a very frustrating place. But that's what God says. Ezekiel 26:13, God says, I will cause the noise of your songs to cease, and the sound of your harps shall be heard no more. He said that to Tyre, and then they came in and they wiped that city out. And that was a little microcosm of what's going to happen when God comes in judgment against the world. There'll never be a song in hell. People will live forever in hell without a note of music, without a song to sing, without anything to relieve the unmitigated judgment that they'll endure. And the only songs that'll ever be sung after God stops the music of the world will be the song of the hearts of the Spirit-filled saints of God that fill the kingdom and go on into eternity, the eternal song of the redeemed. Listen, our song is to come from our hearts and to be distinct and unique. Thirdly, to whom is our song sung? Well, that's clear, isn't it? Chapter 5, verse 19, the end of the verse, it says, to the Lord. It is unto the Lord. All music is to be offered to Him. And you know, you ought to have a checkpoint on your singing at that point. In 2 Chronicles chapter 5, it's a pretty practical illustration here. The great temple has been built. What a glorious day in Israel. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 12, the Levites, who were the singers, all gathered around for the dedication of the temple. And they got there and they were arrayed with white linen. They had cymbals and psalteries and harps. And there were 120 priests playing the trumpet. Can you imagine a 4,000 voice choir with 120 trumpets? Man, what a tremendous experience. And it came to pass as the trumpeters and the singers were as one. What way were they one? To make one sound. They were one in that they all played the same tune the same way and sang the same. In other words, they were good. They were excellent musically. But beyond that, they were one in praising and thanking the Lord, you see. In other words, they were right musically and they were right in their hearts. And it says, and lifted up their voice, singular, one voice, with trumpets and cymbals and instruments and praised the Lord and said, He is good. His mercy endures forever. And God was so pleased, it says, the cloud, the Shekinah glory came down and filled the temple so that the priests could not minister, for the glory of the Lord had filled the house of the Lord. What a beautiful picture. Music glorifying God and God responding by His presence appearing so that they couldn't even minister because His glory blinded them and filled the whole place. And in Revelation, when you hear the great choir sing in the future, they sing unto the Lord, worthy is the Lamb, praise to God. All music was offered to God. Johann Sebastian Bach, really the father in many sense of modern music, said this centuries ago, the aim of all music is the glory of God, end quote. He's right. And so when we sing, we must keep in mind that it's a gift of praise to the Lord. That means that the words that we sing, whatever words of whatever song, should be biblical, right? They should rightly reflect God's thoughts and God's attitudes and God's revelation. And there's a lot of music that just misses it all together. It's theological mishmash. It's doctrinally wrong. Our words need to be right. Not only that, but the tune should be honoring. The vehicle, the method with which we sing. I think sometimes songs are offered to God in a vernacular that is so much of the world that God wouldn't particularly want to be identified with that style because of what it connotes in the system we live in. There ought to be a beauty and a distinctiveness so that it's clear that this is offered to God. Now you say, John, are you saying that it shouldn't have any effect on us, that it's just an offering to God and we don't think about us? Well, you know what's so wonderful? As you're filled with the Spirit and you offer that music to God, it has a fantastic effect on you, doesn't it? And I think God intended it to be that way. Let me show you a great verse, 1 Samuel 16:23. And here you meet David. And David, of course, was a tremendous musician. Among everything else that he did so well, he was a great musician. He was a skillful player, a skillful singer, and a great, great writer of hymns, as the Psalms would witness. But in 1 Samuel 16, verse 23, we find David called on by Saul. Whenever Saul got upset, and Saul got into some real difficult times, he would call David to come and play for him. And just starting in the middle of the verse, it says, David took a harp. David took a harp And he played with his hand. There isn't even any vocalizing apparently at this point. David just plays a harp. And what happened? I know one thing. I know David played it unto the Lord. If David was in the right heart attitude that he was usually in, David was playing his harp to the Lord. But there was a residual benefit to Saul. Look at this. Three things happened. Saul was refreshed, he was made well, and the evil spirit departed from him. You see three things there? Mental, physical, spiritual. Music affected him, first of all, mentally. He was refreshed. He was apparently in a time of tremendous anxiety. His mind was distressed. And yet there was in the music, even though David offered it to God, a refreshment to his troubled mind. It can quiet a troubled mind. There is a corporation in America known as Muzak. And Muzak provides what is called non-entertainment music for industry. For example, when you go to the dentist's office, you wonder why you choose one dentist over another dentist. It isn't his drill. It isn't his smile. It could be his music. The music has a tremendous ability to induce within you a quietness of mind. That is a studied thing. The people in the Muzak Corporation are not primarily musicians. They are behavioral scientists, and they have determined what makes you feel comfortable in the dentist's chair. Same thing is true in a doctor's office. The same thing is true in a factory or a plant. They will guarantee to an employer that if he puts Muzak music into his assembly plant, they will produce more products in less time. There are even percentage figures they can prove. Your mind is literally untroubled or unscrambled by certain kinds of music. And if you just listen to rock music today, you'll know why we have so many psychologically ill people. That kind of music has a direct effect upon upsetting you, scrambling you. Dr. Jay Keenan, the president of Muzak, says this, and I quote, "Unlike drugs, music affects us psychologically and physiologically without invading the bloodstream. Research has indicated the inherent quality of music to influence, listen to this, our metabolism, our heartbeat, and our pulse. Muzak Corporation has made a unique specialization in non-entertainment applications of music as it relates to behavioral sciences. The subtle influence of music has been harnessed in programs providing a controlled stimulus for people at work," end quote. They know what they're doing to people's minds. It has a very obvious effect on productivity, better sales, makes happier people. Music affects our thinking. In the 17th century, there's a very famous German scientist and doctor by the name of Anastasius Kircher, who studied how music affects us physically, and he was the one who discovered if you put water on the rim of a glass and run your finger around, you can make different sounds. He did further study to find out that music causes a reverberation of the air around the body and can cause a variation in the flow of the body fluids, whether blood, saliva, lymph fluid, or whatever. You can actually affect with consonants, dissonance, he said, tempo and pitch. You can affect nerves, muscles, and so forth, as well as the pulse, the heartbeat, the whole thing. Music affects the physical body. And then it can have a spiritual effect. Saul was not only refreshed and made well, but it says, and the evil spirit departed from him. And I think that says it can have a spiritual effect too. And I'm not saying that if you've got evil spirits, play the right tune and they'll leave. I'm not trying to advocate that. But what I am saying is I believe music can have a spiritual ministry in healing somebody's spiritual hurt. Don't you? Oh, I've known it to do that in my life many times. You know, I may be down in the dumps about something, and I'll sit down and listen to some beautiful rendition of I'd Rather Have Jesus Than Anything, and it has a tremendous effect upon my spiritual thoughts. So though music is offered to God, it has a tremendous residual effect to us. God has given it as a wonderful gift. And when it's used properly, it can be refreshment to the mind and healing to the body and restoration to the spirit. All right, so it's important. Let's go back to Ephesians. Now we've got a fourth question to ask. If we are to make this kind of music, and if it's so wonderful as it's offered to God and has a wonderful effect to us, with what do we do it? What is acceptable? I remember when somebody wrote an article about our church and criticized us because we had a guitar played in the church. We actually went that far to have a guitar played in the church. Somebody plucked a string. And I remember that this was a big article and everybody was upset about it, saying we were definitely a liberal church because we had a guitar. Well, who says what we can do? Who says what are the acceptable things? Watch this. This is really, really fabulous. First, there's a general statement in verse 19. The first word is what? Speaking. You know what that word is in Greek? Laleo. You know what it comes from? La, 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 la. La, la, la. Just la-di-da. It's an onomatopoetic word in that sense. It sounds like what it means. La 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 la. It's just sound. That's all. La leo. Just the tongue. La la la. See? It's just the movement of the tongue. When the tongue moves, it goes la 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 la. See? That's it. That's what the word means. It is any sound. In fact, you know, originally, the earliest meaning we can find for it is to chirp. And it is used frequently in classical Greek to speak of the chatter of birds. It is also used of the babble of small children. The babble of small children, the chatter of birds. It is even used of the sounds of animals, the grunts and the groans of the animals and the little noises they make. It is used of the noise of a grasshopper and a cricket in classical Greek. In other words, it means sounds. Have you ever seen a little children's group come up and one kid's got sandpaper and one kid's got two sticks and somebody else got a little triangle and somebody else got a little shaker and they just make noise? That's just sounds. Well, that's the way the word laleo would be used. For example, it's used in Revelation 4:1, where it says the trumpet speaks. It's the sound of a trumpet. It is used often in classical Greek of the sound of musical instruments, harps, horns, drums, everything. It is used in Revelation 10:4 of thunder, the voice of thunder, and thunder makes a sound. Now watch this. What he's saying is, spirit-filled people make noise. And that's right what it says in the Old Testament. Make a joyful what? Noise to the Lord. It's a very broad category. The point is this, any sound offered to the Lord from a spirit-filled heart in the right context, you see, could be a guitar. Could be a violin, could even be a drum, could be a harp, could be a horn, could be a clarinet, a flute, a reed instrument, could be all these things. All the sounds, have you ever thought how God has invented all these incredible sounds? What would it be, a world without music? What would it be? I mean, can you imagine if we couldn't sing, if the human voice was exactly like this and it went like this all the time and we talk computer talk all the time, it's so impersonal and nobody would bother to hear us for more than 10 minutes or their ears would be ringing. But God has made us able to go up and down and all over the scale and to keep people's interest in that way. See? I think God is involved in being praised when out of our hearts rise the sounds, whatever they are, that are to His praise. But He gets very specific. Look at verse 19. What kind of sounds? Two kinds. First, singing. At the end of verse 19, we'll come back to the other part. Singing. Secondly, making melody. Now, these are the two ways. I want to show you what they are. Singing is from the word ado in Greek. It means to sing with the voice. That's one way to make music. Sing with your voice. Nothing wrong with somebody singing with a voice. It's wonderful. I know some places that believe a choir is wrong. You shouldn't have a choir. Why? There were choirs all through the Bible. For those people who sing skillfully, to sing as unto the Lord is a wonderful thing. He says we are to sing with our voice. And you may not have a very good one. That doesn't matter. You're still to sing with your voice. Or you may have a very good one. You're still to sing with your voice as unto the Lord. I really believe, and I don't know about, some of you know more about music than I do, but I believe the human voice is the most beautiful instrument ever made. It has the most flexibility. I mean, there's nothing like it. It's just incredible. The human voice with this glorious flexibility. Maybe the violin comes as close to it as anything can, but the human voice with the highs and the lows and all of the things that it can do and the flexibilities and the glory of that human voice, God has given us an incredible tool for praising Him. Secondly, making melody, and I want to just mention this briefly. Making melody is an unfortunate translation because there's something rich here. We have some churches in America who have taught that musical instruments are sinful and there are not to be musical instruments in the New Testament church. But this verse really sets that aside because the word making melody is psalo. Psalo or psalo, from which we get psalm. It's here salantes. But what it means is to pluck. The root meaning is to pluck, and it was even used of plucking a bowstring when you shot an arrow. You know, you take it with two fingers and pluck it, fire it. It's to pluck. Later it came to pluck a harp. Solomon to pluck a harp. Down through the years then, the word came to mean to play a musical what? Instrument. So you know what he's saying? There's two ways to make sounds, with the voice and with what? Instruments. That's what he's saying. It's beautiful. Solo, to play an instrument. Listen, God can be praised in instrumental music. God can be glorified if the heart is right, even though there are no words, even though there is no particular message, as we call it in the song. Just the melody and its beauty and its magnificence and its harmony and its meter and its rhythm and all of the wonder of how God has created music can be to Him a great praise. By the way, there's going to be instrumental music at the rapture, a trumpet solo. God is pleased with music that comes from instruments that are played by people in their hearts. You can whistle to the Lord. You can hum. You see, all of this is praise to God musically. How wonderful it is that God has given us this tremendous expression. And how, finally, how are we to frame our music? Three ways, he says: psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Now, these are simple. I'm not going to take any time with them. Psalms, simply from psalmos, refers mainly to the Old Testament psalms. The word is used of other things. It sometimes is used of anthems to God. It uses itself in broad categories. But it's interesting to me that Luke uses it exclusively to refer to the psalms. So whenever you run across it in Luke's writings, he has in mind the psalms, which tends to indicate to me that that was its predominant significance. The idea of psalming, singing the Old Testament songs. Now, we don't sing as many psalms as we ought to today. I think something the church has lost with the advent of the hymnal and all of the things where people want copyright and they want to write songs and so forth and so on, we've kind of left out a lot of the psalms. But maybe we ought to sing the psalms more often. You know, there are many groups that sing the psalms. I have some hymnals of nothing but the psalms. That's what the early church sang, the psalms. Now, let me just tell you that the psalms basically spoke of the nature and the work of God. We have many hymns that do that. We have sort of new psalms, those that lift up and glorify God. The psalms were those things that praised the nature and the work of God. Then there were hymns, hymnas. It literally means a song of praise. But if we are to make a distinction, it seems to me that this concept of hymn is frequently connected with the work of Jesus Christ. In Colossians 1, we have a great hymn. I believe that that whole section of Colossians 1 is a hymn where it says, giving thanks unto the Father who has made us fit to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in light, who has delivered us from the power of darkness, has translated us to the kingdom of his dear Son, in whom we have redemption, even the forgiveness of sin, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him were all things created that are in heaven, that are in earth, visible and invisible. There are many scholars that believe that's an early church hymn, and it is a hymn raised to Jesus Christ. There are others who believe that Philippians also in chapter 2 is a hymn to Christ. Hymns were then especially, it seems, suited to be directed at the redemptive work of Christ. So psalms to the character and work of God, hymns to the work of Jesus Christ on the cross, and finally, spiritual songs were like testimonies. Songs, simply a broad term, songs, but songs spiritual, about spiritual things. Let me show you what I mean. A psalm, that would be to hear a great rendition of the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." That would be a psalm. Or maybe even a modern day hymn like, "A mighty fortress is our God," would be a more modern kind of psalm. And then there would be hymns. Hymns such as the Old Rugged Cross, which speaks of the redemptive work of Christ. And then there would be spiritual songs such as, "Oh, how he loves you and me," or "I'd rather have Jesus than anything." Something that speaks of a personal response of testimony. All of these things, whether they're great hymns about God, or whether they're the songs of the cross and the redemption of Christ, or whether they're the great recitations of testimony, all of them are the expressions of a Spirit-filled heart. And beloved, listen, whether it's played or sung, if the heart is right, it pleases God. And again, I say, when you're Spirit-filled, there's going to be a joy that breaks forth in song. A joy that breaks forth in music.
This is Grace to You with John MacArthur. Thanks for tuning in today. John has been pastor of Grace Community Church in the Los Angeles area since 1969. His current study is titled Living in the Spirit. Well, John, as a follow-up to what you said today about singing and worship, I want you to hear a question that came into our Q&A line from a listener named Matthew. I think his question is a common one, especially for believers who are trying to think biblically about the style of music in their church. So we'll play his question, then you respond.
Hi, my name is Matthew, and I am calling from Waukesha, Wisconsin. And I was just wondering what the purpose of music in church today. And is it really worshiping God? And I know that, you know, it's our heart towards God, and it's the knowledge of the word that is worship. So why is there music in the church today?
In the Old Testament, Matthew, the people of God sang his praise. You go back into the book of Exodus, and there are songs, the song of Moses, the song of Miriam, the entire book of Psalms, 150 psalms are songs. They're songs of praise to God. When you come into the New Testament, we are instructed to speak to ourselves in spiritual songs, singing, making melody in our hearts to the Lord. We're called to sing hymns, to sing psalms, to sing spiritual psalms in Colossians. Heaven, if you look at the glimpses of heaven, you find the saints singing the praises of God. Music has a way of releasing our emotions. You know, we're supposed to worship in spirit and in truth, meaning our worship is basically an apprehension of the truth about God in our mind, so we understand the truth of God, and for that we praise him. But we are in our praise also to involve our spirit, and that would be all of our faculties, including our emotion. We are encouraged to sing praise to God. So God has authorized music to his glory. It should be music that articulates and expresses the truth about God. It ought to be rich. When I think about singing to God, what I love about the hymns is I can't come up with those words. I want to praise God. I want to honor God, glorify God, but I don't have the words. So some gifted writers have put together words that can give expression to my faith and my joy and my love and my adoration. For the very reason that God has designed music as an instrument by which we praise him, we sing. That is not in itself worship. It is simply the means God has designed for us to express the emotion and the joy of a worshiping heart.
Thank you, John. And that is a helpful reminder as we prepare for church in a couple of days. Also, this reminder, if you, like Matthew, have a Bible-related question for John, call us on our Q&A line. It's 661-295-6288. Just leave a message for John, and he may answer it on a future broadcast. Contact us today. Again, just call 661-295-6288. Leave your message, and John may answer your question on a future broadcast. In case you didn't get a chance to write it down, here's that number one more time, 661-295-6288. And you'll also find the Q&A number at our website, gty.org. If you enjoyed today's lesson, know that you can help us produce these broadcasts and give solid Bible teaching to spiritually hungry people. Your tax-deductible gifts translate into verse-by-verse teaching in your community and others like it, and throughout most of the English and Spanish-speaking world. Giving to your local church comes first, of course, but we are grateful for anything you can do beyond that. To partner with us, call 800-55-GRACE, or go to our website, gty.org. That's gty.org. Now for John MacArthur, I'm Phil Johnson, reminding you to watch Grace to You television on Sundays. Check your local listings for station and times, and then be here next week. John's going to look at why your memory is one of your greatest tools in the battle against sin. That lesson comes your way Monday when John continues his study, Living in the Spirit. It's another 30 minutes of unleashing God's truth, one verse at a time, on Grace to You.